The following interview contains some colorful language, very familiar to people working in marketing and sales, but probably not suitable for children. Listener discretion is advised.
This is Bob Hoffman, author of Marketing Stinks, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where every Friday I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book. This show has been named one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, and has millions of downloads and listeners in over 185 countries. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, connect and message me on LinkedIn, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And to make sure you never miss an episode, you have a few options. The best way is to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, or go to marketingbookpodcast.com and sign up for email notifications. Or if you're on LinkedIn, find the Marketing Book Podcast page and click the subscribe button and maybe meet some of your fellow listeners. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome back Bob Hoffman to talk about his book-like web thing, Marketing Stinks. Bob Hoffman is the author of several best-selling books about advertising. He's also one of the most sought-after international speakers on advertising and marketing. His books include Ad Scam, How Online Advertising Gave Birth to One of History's Greatest Frauds and Became a Threat to Democracy, Advertising for Skeptics, Laughing at Advertising, Bad Men, How Advertising Went from a Minor Annoyance to a Major Menace, and Marketers Are from Mars, Consumers Are from New Jersey, and all of those books have been featured on the Marketing Book Podcast. He is the creator of the popular Ad Contrarian blog, named one of the world's most influential marketing and advertising blogs by Business Insider. Bob was the CEO of two independent ad agencies and the U.S. operations of an international agency. Bob's commentary has appeared in the BBC World Service, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, MSNBC, the Financial Times, the Australian, New Zealand Public Broadcasting, Fox News, Sky News, Forbes, Canadian Public Broadcasting, and the Marketing Book Podcast, and many other news outlets throughout the world. And, interesting fact, in his youth, he responded to a want ad and was hired to be a writer of adult fiction. He lasted one day at that job. That quitter.
Idiot. I used everything I knew in one day.
Bob, congratulations on your book-like web thing, Marketing Stinks, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome back, friend. I knew this day would come.
Hello, Douglas. You're very excitable today.
Oh, as always, particularly when I'm talking to one of my ad agency brethren. So now, before we get into what a book-like web thing is, and this is a first on the Marketing Book Podcast, listeners, so I hope you all appreciate that. I want to congratulate you on your induction into the Marketing Book Podcast Six-Timers Club.
It's a great honor. Yeah. I'll tell you. My career is complete now.
Yep. Yes. Well, that entitles you to even more discount coupons at any Oakland, California area Taco Bell.
Yo quiero Taco Bell.
What's with the sound effects, man? This is becoming highly produced podcast.
Yeah, I've got a whole team of producers here and everything. Yeah. So now I did check. There are still Taco Bells in Oakland, California.
Yeah, they haven't closed them all yet.
Yeah. Well, so that's what I'm saying. But I could obviously shift it to a different food retailer. Okay. Yeah. So along with that blazer you get with the special seal for being a Marketing Book Podcast frequent guest. Now, listeners should know that you and I met in a bar, as all great relationships begin. I think you would agree.
Yeah.
It was at a conference where you were the keynote speaker, as usual. And because of our many years in the advertising industry, we quickly realized we were on the same wavelength.
Yes.
So, having served in the military myself,
hoo-ah!
When I meet a fellow veteran, there's a kind of a similar connection. And I think that people who have worked for many years in the ad agency business and or who served in the military have a very sensitive bullshit meter, and they have a certain dark, twisted, deranged sense of humor, Bob. And I think both of those describe you.
Oh, stop. I do not. I'm a cheerful guy.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right. So just to give listeners a sense of what I'm talking about, here's an excerpt from a talk you gave at the World Federation of Advertisers, the debate on ad tech in Toronto.
I'm a copywriter. I don't know very much about technology. I don't know very much about media, selling or buying. So why am I here today shooting my mouth off about ad tech? Because although I don't know much about technology or media, I think I know a little something about bullshit. I spent 41 years in the agency business. You think you're full of shit? I have a Lifetime Achievement Award.
And congratulations on that as well.
Yeah, I'm proud of that.
Yeah. So the other thing I should mention is that in addition to being a member of the Marketing Book Podcast Six Timers Club, you're the third person in that group. The other two are two nice Italian boys from Ohio, Joe Polizzi and Anthony Annarino. Mm-hmm. You're a part of Marketing Book Podcast lore in that because of you, I had to produce the Bob Hoffman Listener Discretion Advisory, which listeners will have already heard, but I want you to hear it.
The following interview contains some colorful language, very familiar to people working in marketing and sales, but probably not suitable for children. Listener discretion is advised.
Your listeners have no discretion or they wouldn't be listening.
That's right. That's right. Oh, my goodness. My goodness. So, listen. It occurred to me, and this is just a free idea, Bob. I'm full of ideas as long as I don't have to implement them. But your book, Marketing Stinks, and it's spelled MKTGSTINX. That would be a great name for a hair metal band.
Yeah.
So you might want to copyright it. That's all I'm saying.
You know what? I have already trademarked it. I'm going to do mugs and T-shirts, but now I'm going to do a band too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know. You're welcome. So I want to read from the what you have on this, and it's a website. So the book is free for all listeners. That's just a little bonus. I just want you to know that. But it's just for the listeners. Everyone else have to pay. So you write that there have been thousands of books and articles extolling the virtues of marketing and advertising, but I don't think there has ever been one about how stupid and wasteful most of it is. Well, now there is. So, Bob,
yeah.
What is a book-like web thing? Because this is a first for me.
Yeah, let's start at the beginning. I wanted to do a book about how stupid most marketing is, and I have written about that for many years, and I thought I'd put some pieces that I thought were pretty good together and do a book about it. But I wanted to use audio and video, and you can't use audio and video in a printed book. The only way to do it is on the web. So I decided that I would do it that way. And also, I wanted it to be free because I want people to be able to see a different point of view about advertising and marketing. And, we don't make any money writing books about advertising and marketing anyway. The only one who makes money is Jeff Bezos. So,
let's not overlook those Taco Bell discount coupons.
Yeah, that's
true. Do need to declare those on your taxes, by the way.
So, I wanted it to be free. And there, also, publishing a book is a pain in the ass, and I'm too lazy to go through that again. And it really, in this day and age, why do you need a book? You can say the same things online but when you publish a book, you're a big shot all of a sudden. Oh, look, here's a book I did. But if you do it online, all you got is a website, and everyone has a website. So there's no prestige in that. But I don't care about that. So I thought, I'll just put it online, and I'll make it free, and let everyone do it. And also, I'm I'm too impatient to work with publishers. Mm-hmm. I don't like working with publishers. They're a pain in the ass, and everything takes forever. And yeah, they probably make the book 10 or 15% better, but it's not worth the pain for me. I'm too impatient.
Well, and you know, at this point, by being on the Marketing Book Podcast six times, your reputation is kind of shot now that no book is going to help.
You got a good point there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, yeah. There's no off position on the Genius Switch, Bob Hoffman. So I want to read just the excerpt, one excerpt from the beginning here that's on the website, and then talk to you about some of the big issues, some of the big topics, and then spend time on ad tech, because that's just all your books I've read about that have just really – upset me, probably for all the right reasons. So, you write, many otherwise sensible people seem to possess an unhealthy and bewildering confidence in the practice of marketing. I'm afraid I don't share their enthusiasm. After over 40 years in and around the marketing and advertising industries, I find myself more skeptical than ever. I am happy to say that I have met some brilliant marketing people, but just some. There have been a number of big-name companies who have entrusted hundreds of millions of dollars to me to help them sell their stuff. In order to do that, I had to pretend to listen to marketing wisdom. I listened respectfully. Then I mostly ignored the experts and did it my way. Of course, there were times they wouldn't let me do it my way. This involved months of research and focus groups and reports and PowerPoint presentations and meetings about PowerPoint presentations and reports about meetings and meetings about memos and memos about reports about meetings. In other words, an undiluted, full-bodied, multidisciplinary clusterfuck that invariably resulted in some horse shit about quality and value. Thank God for the listener discretion advisory. This thing, I like to think of it as a book-like web thing, is my revenge. I've cherry-picked some stuff I've written and videos I've been a part of about the foibles, failures, and fecklessness of traditional marketing wisdom. I've compiled them here for my own entertainment and hopefully yours. Even if you hate this book-like web thing, I think it's worth perusing. It will give you the perspective of a smart-ass know-it-all, that's me, who has made a lot of money ignoring the opinions of experts. And if you like what you read here, maybe you'll even buy one of my real books. Hey, a guy can dream, can he? So it's like 47 little chapters, and some of them are the videos, one of which I pulled the audio from. So it actually... It might take you a while to get through it. Some of them are very short, some of them are longer. But also, having read your other books, I really enjoyed it. It was sort of like a trip down memory lane in a certain regard, and kind of a great roundup. So,
I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, like I say, you know, I kind of get you, Bob. You know, you remind me of so many people I worked in the ad agency industry with, particularly people from New York like you.
Yeah.
And the thing that I miss about these the New Yorkers in particular is that I always knew where I stood with New Yorkers, you know? And like even if a creative director, let's say, was telling me to perform an anatomically impossible act on myself, I knew where I stood with him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. When I came out to California and a friend of mine who had been here before said, you know, Bobby, he said, coming from New York, if you're doing a lousy job, they're going to let you know in half a minute. They're going to be in your face. You go to California and you'll think you'll be doing great. And 6 months later, you'll be fired.
Yes.
They don't tell you. They don't, you know, but you're right. New Yorkers are there's no discretion in New York.
People I miss that. You know, and now I live in Virginia, and I run into a few more Southerners, and sometimes they're a little difficult to decode. And I believe a lot of that directness of New Yorkers comes from the Dutch, since they founded New York.
Yeah.
And that's an observation, not a criticism. I love my Dutch listeners. There's so many of them.
Hey, they're very – hey, don't get into issues here. We don't want people suing us for being insensitive.
Oh, that's careful, right. That's right.
Be careful what you say about the Dutch, my friend.
Oh, I love them. I love them. Yeah, I've actually interviewed a Dutch author.
Have you?
Okay. Yeah, I could listen to that accent all day long.
You just watch yourself here, pal.
Okay. Well, thank you for that advice, Bob, but I hear that from people every day. So let's get into, like I said, some of the broader topics, and then I want to zero in on the ad tech. And what I wanted to do was – quote from a few places in the book that I pulled out, and then basically each one of these is going to be like lighting a Bob Hoffman fuse. Yeah. So you can explain, you know, what's going on behind some of these. And I wanted to start with one that was one of the posts that was called Kings, Popes, and Advertisers.
Yeah.
And you write, having spent more decades than is healthy in advertising, my view is that it is a fascinating business. What makes advertising fascinating is that to be good at it, you have to understand one of the most incomprehensible of subjects, people. And to acquire an understanding of how people actually work requires a skill that most advertisers and marketers don't possess. Explain.
Well, marketers aren't stupid, okay? Marketers are smart enough to understand what they've been taught, but they're not smart enough to question what they've been taught, has been my experience. And they've been taught certain things about how people react to marketing, how people react to, and they believe it, and they don't question it. And as a result, there's so much uninspiring marketing. Because marketers, they're terrible at improvising, you know? They've been taught truths, and they believe these truths, and they learn the fundamentals, and they know all the right moves, and they're encouraged to apply what they've been taught to every circumstance, but they're not encouraged to make things up, to improvise. And improvisation is essentially what creativity is about. It's about taking things that everyone sees, but you see differently. You improvise. You find something different about it. And we're not good at that. We're not good at understanding how people really work. We're good at understanding what we've been taught about how people work. And that's you know, that's really the essence of what I write about on in this book like web thing. And so, you know, that's the big picture.
Right. Well, back to marketers are from Mars, consumers are from New Jersey. And yeah. I have to say that sometimes when I've given talks, one of the things I talk about is marketers have an image problem.
Yeah.
So naturally, a big picture of you and that book cover comes up when I start quoting from it, particularly as it relates to brand bullshit, which we'll talk about in a minute. Yep. And that is, you know, related to this one about marketers. And you write, marketers and consumers, and by consumers, I mean, you know, people, are from different worlds. Consumers are basically simple creatures with straightforward needs and easily observed behaviors. Marketers are complicated critters with strange customs and mysterious beliefs. And I guess you've seen a lot of the disconnect. I see it all the time.
Yeah. Well, we have to complicate the shit out of everything to make ourselves valuable, right? Mm-hmm. If we were to say, people buy most stuff because they're familiar with it and it looks comfortable and it's pretty. You don't need to spend tens of thousands of dollars to figure that out. We need to come up with brand meaning, brand meaning. This means this to them. And so that, you know, that you can charge for. You can't charge for common sense, but you can charge for bullshit. And so we're really good at developing bullshit to sell to people and make ourselves important. See, we have to be important. Otherwise, we can't charge for what we do. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Most marketers have a hard time recognizing that while their brand is vitally important to them, it is of little consequence to their customers. If you're a marketer and you believe people love your brand because they happen to buy it, you're kidding yourself. And you went on to talk about how, like, one study showed 75% of the consumers would not care if 75% of the brands they use disappeared.
Yeah.
And I think that's a low number.
It probably is. And, you know, we have to defend that because that's what our industry has become about. And so, you know, we've made up a lot of stuff that, you know, we don't question it. we're not smart enough to question, is this really true? Is it really true that people, you know, buy things that only have meaning to them, that are meaningful to them, that they want to be part of a tribe or a community, and they want to have conversations about brands? It's all bullshit. People don't want to. I mean, you know, there are some brands that are meaningful to us. There's probably three or five brands that have a particular meaning. You know, I'm an Apple guy. I like Apple. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but I like that. So that, you know, but we deal with thousands of brands. We don't feel that way about most of the stuff we buy on automatic pilot. Just watch people in the supermarket. They, you know, they get you bumblebee tuna. That's what they put in. They don't, you know, question, is this brand in line with my philosophy? No. It's hard to convince marketers that they need to simplify things, that they need to get down to the real world of how people really work. And the way people really work is they buy stuff that they're familiar with and that feels comfortable to them. And that's about as deep as they go.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me of a book that was on the show a while back by Alan Adamson called Seeing the How. And he talked about how, I can't remember if it was a client or a company, but they were interviewing people. I think it was a pizza chain they were dealing with. And they would interview people and they'd say, yeah, we love the pizza chain. It's great. And so they thought, oh, well, this, you know, this is really great. They have a lot of brand loyalty. And then somebody had the sense to say, well, if this chain went away, how would that affect you? And they said, no, not at all. We would just go to the other one down the street.
Right. I mean, you know, every brand thinks they have brand, particularly the successful ones. You know, like Coke and Pepsi, I'm sure if you went into their headquarters, you'd see documents about what Coke means to the, and what Pepsi means. And you go out on the street and you ask people, what's the difference between Coke and Pepsi? And they'll say, I don't know, Coke is in a red can. You know, you ask them, what's the difference between Chevy and Ford? I don't know. My dad bought Ford, so I buy Fords. And that's, you know, in most cases, that's about as deep as it goes. Now, are there instances in which brands do have a lot? Sure, there are. There are some instances where that holds true. In marketing, there are no absolutes. There's just likelihoods and probabilities.
Right.
And the likelihood and the probabilities are, in most cases, in a great majority of cases, brands don't have tremendous meaning to people. And you buy brands that you're familiar with, and you buy brands that you're comfortable with, and you don't go sussing out what they mean and how that relates to what you believe. No.
Yeah, well, now, when you do mention the difference between Coke and Pepsi, I do know that Pepsi is the brand of soft drink they serve at protests where Kendall Jenner is handing out Pepsi to the police officers. So
So that's important.
You got that going for it.
Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, so now you just touched on this, likelihoods and probabilities. I want to drill into that.
Yeah.
You write, this is under the chapter called Check Your Logic at the Door, which is actually what you don't want – anyway, you write, as business people, we are taught to think logically. The logic of business is mostly quite simple. If I do A, then B will happen. In other words, it is the logic of cause and effect. For most business activities, cause and effect is the right way to think. It is not the right way to think about advertising. And you go on to write, the right way to think about advertising is likelihoods and probabilities. Explain.
Yeah, you know, marketers want their advertising to be a court case. You know, we are, you know, our brand of whatever, pickles, does this, and their brand of pickles does that, and our pickles are better because they're natural and they have less sodium, and they're this, and they want to make a court case, and whoever who has the better court case wins. And that's how they think advertising works. But advertising doesn't work like that. In my opinion, advertising works by creating fame. And the most important thing that advertising does is make a brand famous. If you are famous, you have such an advantage over your competitors that are not famous. And this goes in all aspects of it. I mean, why did Donald Trump become president of the U.S.? Because he was famous. He had that TV show for 12 or 14 years, and he was famous and became president. If that was a webinar, I guarantee you he would not have been president of the United States. And fame is a remarkable benefit in life and in business. And marketers don't realize, marketers think that advertising is about differentiation and positioning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to some extent, those are valuable things. But most important, the most important thing advertising does is make a brand famous and keep a brand famous.
That part brought to mind. There's no bullshit like brand bullshit. And you go on and talk about, you know, how folks want to have relationships with brands and be a part of a tribe and a community. But you talk about the importance of marketing and differentiation and positioning. But the whole fame thing seems to be missed. And I want to ask, you go on to say we have two competing models of consumer behavior, the rational model and the emotional model.
Yeah.
And what talk about is it a similar thing? And I can't resist. I got a quote. You write, "I'm convinced that many people who bought Gwyneth Paltrow's famous $75 This Smells Like My Vagina candle also saved 39 cents by buying bargain peanut butter the next day." Discuss.
Yeah. People are not consistent in their behavior. People and the same person who will spend, $150,000 to buy a car, you know, an Aston Martin car, will also buy bargain golf balls because they're 85 cents cheaper than regular golf balls. And you know, we think we put people into categories. He's a this and she's a that, and they do things this way and we do things that way. And people are very hard to pin down, and it's very hard to come up with. You know, the researchers love to put people into silos. He's a young adventurist, and he's an older conservative, and you know, all these kind of sociological nonsense things that they create. But people are much more complex and hard to understand than that, and they can, you know, I called it quantum advertising or something. It's like quantum mechanics and physics. Sometimes it acts like a particle, sometimes it acts like a wave, and you don't know how it's going to behave. And it's the same thing with human beings. Sometimes they do it this way, sometimes they do it that way, and understanding humans, you know, marketing people think they need to understand how marketing works. They don't. They need to understand how human beings work. And how human beings work is very complex, and it's all about probabilities. There's no absolutes. There's no black and white. There's no yes and no. It's way more complicated than that, and the best you can do is you're not going to get it right all the time. The best you can do is go with probabilities and hope that, you know, what you think is the most probable way to do things is the correct way to do things, because you're not going to be absolutely right.
Well, let me ask another question that's going to upset people. You write about how our industry's obsession with data and metrics has been damaging. And I got to believe you don't say, you know, those aren't good things. Those aren't bad things to have. But talk about the overwhelming obsession.
Yeah. Data is, you know, a fancy word for information. You have to have information to make reasonable decisions. There's nothing wrong with having data. The problem is everyone has the same data. You think Coke has data that Pepsi doesn't have? You think Ford has data that Chevy doesn't have? They all have the same. And if they don't have the same data, with two clicks of a mouse, they can buy the same data. And that's not what makes the difference. That's not what makes one brand more successful than the other. What makes one brand more successful is how you deal with the data, the interpretation of the data, the human element, what human beings do with that data to create either a strategy or a creative idea or a product idea. That's where the value is. The data is just a bunch of bricks laying around on the ground. So then someone has to build a house with it. And that's what human beings do that data doesn't do.
I had a book on the show recently by Eric Siegel called The AI Playbook. And it was all about implementing machine learning for companies. And he was talking about how the overwhelming number of these projects fail. And AI is oversold and explains the big problem. The reason that companies are hemorrhaging money and not getting benefit is because of the humans. You have to deal with the humans to help them not be so fearful and to get them to understand what you just said. You know, in fact, the book is very popular with the data people because they want the civilians they work with to read it. So they'll understand that it's not black magic here. There's a lot more to it.
I don't know about AI. I don't know where it's going. I don't think any, you know, the people who say they know where AI is going, I think they're full of shit. They don't know anything. We've only had it with us for like a half hour. And who knows what it's going to be like 5 years from now or even 18 months from now. I think there is a lot about AI that we don't know, that we think we know. And there are a lot of questions about whether it's going to be positive or negative or is it going to do good or is it going to do harm? I don't think we have answers yet, and I don't think we have anything close to answers yet. And I think our government has been unbelievably irresponsible in dealing with these questions, just as it has been irresponsible in dealing with the harms that ad tech has created. And I know you want to talk about that a little later, so I'll save that.
Yeah, and you know, it brings to mind, I'm actually reading Andrew Roberts' big biography of Napoleon right now. And sure enough, they talk in the book about how Josephine, her teeth, because she grew up on a sugar island in the Caribbean back in the 1700s, before they knew about the damage of sugar, and she didn't have white teeth, she had like black nubs in her mouth. So her picture was always painted with her mouth closed. And I remember you talked about that in your book. And all this talk about – so in other words, even then they didn't quite know what they were doing and the damage that could happen. And at the same time, I can remember in the early 90s living in New York City working at Gray Advertising, and I was watching one Sunday morning show by Fortune magazine. You can explain to the younger listeners what a magazine is. But there were these experts talking about this thing that was coming along called the internet, and it's right about where we are now with our discussion of AI. And these experts were sitting there talking about, well, I think it might be this or it could be that. I'm not sure. And I remember one of the panelists said, I think it's going to come through a computer that's going to be on people's desks. Because everyone was thinking, oh, it's all going to be through the television. that just reminds me of kind of where we are. So I guess I'm not quite as concerned as so many marketers and businesses seem to be. It is definitely the shiny object.
Oh, there's no question about that. And, it may turn out to be tremendously valuable, but it may turn out to be more horseshit. We don't know. And I think that I wish that the people who are supposed to be responsible for the welfare of society were more concerned about this than they are, because I don't see anything happening that is protecting against the potential dangers.
Yeah, and I can't remember where it was. It must be I listened to the Wall Street Journal News podcast. I think it was there where they were talking about how more and more organizations or states are, I don't know if they can pass laws, but they're talking about the danger of social media for children and teenagers.
Oh, absolutely. It's a big issue. You know, the Europeans are way ahead of us.
Yes.
They are. They have passed legislation and they're trying to do stuff to protect kids from these dangers. But here in the U.S., where, Washington is a clown show. And, you know, they've had, talk about the tech titans, they've had over 40 hearings in Washington at which senators, they pound the desk and they preen and they give lectures to Mark Zuckerberg and to all these, and they give him hell, and then they haven't passed one damn thing, not a single piece of legislation about the dangers that of ad tech and what it's doing to society. So, and I think we should expect the same on AI, that these clowns will do nothing, and AI will, you know, I don't know which way it's going, but if it goes bad, it's going to go bad quickly and destructively.
Well, and let's remind ourselves that they're not there to pass legislation. They're there to raise money to get reelected. Yeah. And those the video clips of them yelling at Zuckerberg are very helpful.
Right.
So let's transition to something else. I like sales. You know, I admire salespeople, and I've had probably over 70 books on the show about sales, because marketers who don't understand selling and sales are just not as successful. And I think they're at risk of being considered an arts and crafts party planner who works in the make it pretty department. And you've got a few things that talk about this. And again, I'm sure this will upset some folks, but you talk about the bottomless pit of masturbatory self-delusion called brand purpose. And you go on to write, you see, these days there exists a certain species of corporate dipshit who is unwilling to admit that they are in the crass business of making money. And then in another one, you write, if you are in marketing or advertising, you're a salesman. It doesn't matter what you think you are or what you want to be, you're a salesman. One of the problems advertising has always faced is that there are a lot of people in the business who don't want to be salespeople. And I just want you to tell the story. You said you were sitting in a client meeting and the client was talking to us about doing a new campaign. One of my agency MBA geniuses, I guess that's a subspecialty, he asked the client the question they always ask when they have nothing to contribute and wanted to sound engaged. Quote, what is your objective for this campaign? You then passed him a note that said, please see me after the meeting. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, I said, if I ever hear you ask a client again what the objective of the campaign is, you're going to be fired, because every campaign has the same objective, and that is to sell shit. And if you don't know that, how the hell did you ever get an MBA? But, you know, there are a lot of people in our business who really don't want to be salespeople. And you know what? If you don't want to sell, that's fine. That's fine with me. But don't be in the marketing or advertising business if you don't want to sell. You know, go to join UNICEF or something. But if you're going to be in our business, you have to understand that it's about selling stuff. That's not complicated, is it? I don't think so, but they all want to have brand purpose. You know, they're going to change they're really not about selling things. It's really about changing the world. Get out of here. You're not going to change the world. You can't. The people hate marketers. They hate advertising. You think they're going to listen to you about what the world should be like? I mean, these people are so out of touch with reality. It blows my mind.
Well, and with all of your books, you always it's really irritating how you back it up with research. And I can't remember. It wasn't in this particular work you did. But I know that there was a study by the Fornays Group, and I believe they're in London. And it was about how much CEOs trust their CFOs and their chief marketing officers. You've probably heard this. And most of them trust their chief financial officers. But only 20% trusted their chief marketing officers. And what they meant by that terminology is that they didn't trust that the marketing people understood the financial realities of their business.
Yeah, and I'm not sure the CEOs are right about that. I think most CMO, you know, more than 20% of CMOs understand that, you know, you got to make money.
Oh, this is a CEO problem. Yeah.
The problem is it's a CEO problem, and B, the marketers talk in cliches that make them sound stupid. They talk in jargon. They don't talk like human beings. If they would just simplify what they're saying instead of talking in marketing mumbo jumbo, that's what gives people the impression that they're full of shit. And it's easy to correct, but they can't do it. They just can't. They are, you know, they've learned a language and they've learned a vocabulary and they don't know how to get out of their own way and talk like human beings.
So let's go to another topic, which, okay. You know, I just want to congratulate you because this podcast has listeners in over 185 countries and you have now triggered marketers in over 185 countries. God. So why stop now, right?
Why stop? Let's go.
So let's go for another one here. You write, there is a great deal of nonsense in the advertising and marketing business, and I think it's very healthy to appreciate the absurdity. I blame all the nonsense on conferences, which was surprising because a lot of conferences have you come speak, but why do you blame all this nonsense on conferences?
The conferences kind of back up and give ammunition to all the misconceptions. Who speaks at conferences? It's people with a successful story to tell, and they tell you about this marketing miracle or that marketing miracle,
like Apple or Nike.
Yeah, and then you try the marketing miracle and it doesn't work, and you wonder why. How come? Everyone seems to be successful with this but me. Well, the truth is everyone isn't successful with it. It's only the successful stories that get told. The successful stories by the famous brands, which constitute maybe 2% of all marketing activity. Most marketing activity in the world is not by famous brands in famous places at famous conferences, giving histories and case histories and that kind of stuff, and so the whole industry and these are also the things that are covered in the trade press. So you read about it. You read about it in the business section, and you know everything you read about in the business section is one or two standard deviations from normal. It's not what happens in the regular everyday marketing of regular everyday products, and you can't believe everything that you read about in case histories. You have to go deeper than that. In the case histories of famous brands where their stories are told in conferences and in trade publications. That's not everyday marketing. Those are outliers. Those stories become legendary and people believe them, and they think that NFTs are going to be fabulous for their company because they worked for someone.
Right.
And they think putting a QR code in your ad is going to be fantastic. No, it's not a substitute for thinking straight. But these marketing miracles are all over the place, and you know you can't escape them.
Well, Bob, I'm here to tell you, do you know what the future is? The future of marketing?
The future, let me guess. What's the future this week? No, what is it? Tell me, Douglas.
Google+.
Google+ is the future. Yeah.
Yeah, the same folks that were saying that, in all the AI experts on LinkedIn, and they were talking about NFTs and the metaverse and all that sort of thing. And I have to make an admission to you and my my very good-looking listeners. There's a Chrome plugin that I have called Newsfeed Eradicator, and I had to turn it on for LinkedIn because I just don't want to see all that nonsense. And, you know, but you talk about these well-known case studies. I saw a post by Jay Baer the other day, and I think he said he's driving like an RV from his home in Indiana to the West Coast, I think for a speaking thing, with his wife and so forth. And he said that he's meeting all these small businesses and great restaurants and so forth and so on. And he said, you know, I can't stand these books and speakers who only talk about the most famous companies. Right. He says, there's plenty of examples in these small businesses if you just get out of your office and drive across the country. So I want to It really resonated with me what you were talking about. That I just want to quote from all these miracles people talk about. You say, have you ever wondered why the highly touted marketing miracles you read about in the press never seem to work for you? And then you go on to write, before you take any story or report about an advertising or marketing activity as indicative of a general truth, you'd be wise to assume that the fact it is being told at all makes it likely that it is one or two standard deviations from normal. You should assume that the overwhelming number of stories that haven't been told on the subject are not nearly as rosy. And that goes back to the very first thing you said about people should question these things.
So. Yes. That's the most important thing you can be. If you're a marketer, the most important thing you attribute you can have is skepticism. Mm-hmm. You have to really not believe all the baloney that you're fed. You have to do your own searching. You have to, you know, if you just take the standard stuff that you're fed and that you read, you're not going to be very good.
Yeah. Just one last thing I want to ask you about before we can jump to the ad tech, and that is it's just two things. We say there seems to be a consensus these days that advertising in the whole is pretty stinky. There are all kinds of explanations for this. I have my own theory. And you go on to write that I believe that advertising has become tethered to youth culture in a way that is undermining imaginative thinking, harming our creative output, and seriously limiting marketing effectiveness. And then I want to tie that together with another one where you say, I am often criticized by those who don't agree with my incautious opinions about the direction of our industry. That's fine. After a while, I don't agree with some of the things I write myself. But there is one line of criticism that I find truly annoying. It is the idea that I am an old traditional ad guy, and therefore I don't get it.
Yeah. That's there are legitimate areas for people to disagree. You know, intelligent people can make a case for, you know, one point of view or another.
And they can change their mind.
But ad hominem, you know, you can't be right because you're old. You can't be right because you're black. You can't be right because you're a woman. That's just bullshit. That's lazy, stupid thinking. But that's essentially a lot of the criticism I get. Oh, he's just old. He doesn't get it. I fucking get it. Don't tell me I don't get it. And, you know, young people, God bless them, lovely, I love them, they contribute about nothing to the economy. You know, we're still chasing 18 to 34-year-olds, and maybe they're, I don't know, 20% of the economy. You know, people over 50 are over half the economy.
And people, they buy half of all new cars?
They buy 57% of all new cars, people over 50. But the point is that the marketing industry is tethered to young people, to the culture of youth, for some reason that is way out of proportion to their contribution to sales. And it has been this way forever. This is nothing. There's like 40 years. We've had 40 years of this where the marketing industry thinks that they need to be talking to 20-year-olds who have no money, don't buy anything, you know, and it just makes no sense. But they see everyone else doing it, so they think they're supposed to do that too. And you know, and the rationale you get is, well, you know, older people, they want to be like young people. So we have – that's bullshit. I don't want to be – do you want to be like young – I don't want to be like young people. I want to be youthful, but I don't want to be like young people. There's a very important distinction there. There's a difference between wanting to be youthful and wanting to be like young people. I don't want to be like Cardi B, but this is so ingrained in the marketing industry that they are ignoring the most powerful marketing entity in the history of the world, and that is people over 50, and they're just pretty much ignored. It makes absolutely no sense.
And speaking of Cardi B, and her crowd, you write, in a more discerning age, entertainers were called fools. Today, entertainers have become oracles.
Yes.
So we should look to entertainers on how we should market and how we should think about, I'll give you an example. You know, we should look to LeBron James for advice on Chinese-American relations and, you know, things like that.
Yeah. But for some reason, celebrity, I guess it's pretty obvious, celebrity has become such a big deal in culture. These people, you know, being a good singer or being a good basketball player doesn't make you a genius. I'm sorry. I mean, you know, maybe Heinrich Himmler had a beautiful baritone voice. Who knows? There are all kinds of talents that are unrelated. And the ability to sing and the ability to think straight are not necessarily correlated. And we have to get beyond the idea that celebrities are oracles. They ain't.
Right. Okay, so we don't have any marketers or young people listening, and that's fine. Okay, let's jump to ad tech, and I want to talk about this interactivity, another one of those wonderful mirages, like Google+. You write there, there is apparently no end to marketers' ability to delude themselves. Talk about how this a delusion of interactivity came about.
Yeah. You know, because LeBron James has a million followers probably on whatever social media platforms he's on, and, you know, people, you know, other celebrities have. So we thought that people would also want to interact with us, with marketers. And you know what? They couldn't care less about interacting with marketers. It is completely, it's a non-starter. That, you know, social media marketing was supposed to be about sharing, and it was supposed to be about conversations. And it never happened. What social media marketing has become is traditional paid advertising on social media platforms.
Which works real well.
It works fine, but it's not sharing. It's not conversations. It's not all the interactive baloney that we were fed.
Yeah, in fact, this lure of interactivity, people pay even more now to avoid ads.
Yes, they're willing to pay. I certainly am. I have become, I'm disillusioned. I see so little decent advertising.
Yeah.
It's really disheartening to me to see how much terrible advertising there is. What happened to us? Now, there was always a lot of bad advertising. You know, advertising was 80 to 85% crap. Now it's 90 to 95% crap.
Yeah.
It's hard to find good stuff.
But I don't think there's not many people saying, well, was it a creative idea? Does it appeal to the people that actually use our product? Instead, it's no, look how much reach we got. Look how much frequency. Look how, but let's go further there. You write that, this conspiracy of silence. And again, this is what because I've read your other books, it really freaks me out. And I'll include links to all your other episodes that have been on this on this podcast, on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. But you write that for several years, the advertising industry has engaged in a conspiracy to deceive its clients and the public about online advertising. And so for those folks who haven't read Ad Scam or Bad Men, you back it up with so much irrefutable research that you prove that this conspiracy. Talk about just how much fraud. Is it only second to drugs in terms of organized crime?
Yeah, according to the World Federation of Advertisers, by next year, by 2025, online ad fraud will maybe the second largest source of criminal income in the world after drug trafficking. You know, nobody knows for sure how much fraud there is. There's no international registry of fraud, but it is, you know, reliable people and reliable organizations believe that about 20% of everything that happens online for advertisers is fraudulent. That means about right now, that means about $80 billion of fraud online annually. And the advertising industry either knows this and is hiding it, or doesn't know it and is stupid. It's one, I don't know which is worse, but there is clearly a desire to hide these facts from advertisers and from the public. And we have been very irresponsible in allowing this to happen, because where are those $80 billion going annually? They're either going to fund organized crime, or they're going to state-sponsored fraudsters who are out to undermine democratic institutions. You know, it's going to bad guys is where it's going. And we're not doing a damn thing about it. And the advertising industry is responsible. The advertising industry is funding all this fraudulent activity.
Right. And you write that among all the scandals, improprieties, and damaging revelations that the press has uncovered about ad tech and online advertising, not one agency has exposed any of that, and they actually probably have more insight to it than some of the some of the journalists are.
Right. How does a journalist who is not trained in marketing, is not trained in advertising, is not trained in media, come up with all this information, all these scandalous stories about what's happening online, when advertising people who are trained in this, who know, haven't come up with a single one? Every day, well, maybe not every day, every week we read about another scandal related to online advertising activity. And we've never had a single one of these scandals exposed by an agency that's supposed to know what's going on online.
Yeah.
That's really scary.
Can you shed some light on the fact that for every $1 bought of programmatic ads, you only get 3 cents of real display ads viewed by a real human?
Yeah. In Marketing Stinks, you'll see something called the programmatic poop funnel. And it shows
That's what this is from, yeah.
Yes. And it shows what happens to a dollar of programmatically bought advertising. Now, let's remember, online advertising is bought in two basic ways, direct and programmatically. And programmatically bought advertising constitutes probably about 80%, somewhere between 70 and 90% of online advertising bought programmatically. And you know, there are hybrid versions of direct and programmatic, but we're talking about in as general categories. So about 80% of the advertising online is bought programmatically, bought by computers. Out of every dollar, and these are all according to reliable sources. You can read it in Marketing Stinks. You could see who the sources are. Mm-hmm. 50%, 50 cents of that dollar goes to middlemen, who are doing data, and they're doing targeting, and they're doing all kinds of stuff that is impossible to figure out what it means. But it's half the dollar goes there. Then there is visibility issues constitute about 30%, where ads are not visible when online. Then there's fraud, which is probably another 20%. And then there's the amount of online, programmatically bought online advertising that is actually viewed. And so what you come down to is about 3 cents of every advertising dollar spent on programmatic advertising. Does it actually buy an ad and a viewer? And you can see the math there if you care to look at it.
Yeah, I'll include that picture of that on your episode's website page and a link to that specific one as well as the overall thing. Let's talk about something else that, again, in case we – it's been a few minutes since we've irritated marketers. So write under the subhead of perverse incentives and blind eyes. Wasting millions of dollars buying fake advertising is a terrible thing for a brand or a business, but it's not so terrible for the personal interest of a marketer. How does ad fraud make marketers look good and balance sheets look bad?
Perverse incentives. It's marketing executives know how much waste there is in programmatic advertising, but they still do it anyway. And why do they do it? Because it gives them good data. They may be buying bots, but they don't care because in the reports that they can show their CFO and their CEO, they're buying lots of reach. They think, they know that they're not buying people, but they don't have to say that out loud. And their cost per thousands is very low, which is great. Why is it low? Because you're not buying human beings. You're buying bots and you're buying junk. And, as opposed to traditional advertising where low cost per thousand was a good thing, it means you were being efficient. In online advertising, low cost per thousands usually mean you're being conned, you're being had, you're buying bots, you're not buying human beings, you're not buying real traffic, you're not buying real websites. But it makes you look good. What CMO wants to go into his CEO and say, oh, by the way, our cost per thousand went up 30% this quarter? What? Why? Well, we've decided to buy actual human beings instead of bots and phony websites. You mean you've been doing that all along? We kind of have been. Well, why didn't you know that? Well, we were blah, blah, blah. So, it's a very difficult bind to get yourself out of because you're used to reporting great things. And that the fact that it's all baloney makes it even worse when you try to fix it because you can't explain that you were asleep at the wheel for the past 5 years.
So, what should businesses and marketers be doing if they, in fact, know how much they're being ripped off?
Well, what they should do is, number one, hire some people who they trust who will tell them the truth about what they're buying. And I'm not going to mention any names because I don't want to leave anyone. But there are people who are reliable who can tell you what you're really buying and how you're really buying it. And I am not talking about the people, the very large companies that do fraud. Those people are unreliable. But there are certain individuals who you can rely on and who have methodologies for showing you what's really happening with your online advertising dollars. And you can figure out who those people are. You should be able to.
Well, do you think that's also – what's also at play is this idea of, well, we're running ads. Like, you've heard of the expression, no one ever got fired for running an ad?
Yeah.
So it seems like, well, they're doing something.
Yeah. Activity, activity as a replacement for progress. I am convinced that if we took the amount of money – that we gave to marketers and we gave it to bright high school kids, there wouldn't be that much difference. If we told them, you go ahead and promote our product, what would you do? There wouldn't be that much difference in the end result, because I think so much of what's happening in marketing is wasted.
Just one more question about ad tech, and that is, can you tell the story about that accident that happened that revealed all the ad fraud?
Yeah. So
with the USA Today, I believe it was.
Yeah, it was USA Today.
Or Gannett.
Yeah. So Gannett Publishing publishes USA Today, and it also publishes about 250 little community news websites and major advertisers. I'm talking about very big name advertisers were buying advertising on USA Today. And some researchers, just by chance, discovered that the advertising that was supposed to be running on USA Today actually was running on these little, tiny, local news websites.
Like the one in Reno, I think you mentioned.
Yeah, there was one in New Mexico, and there was one in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. And Gannett wasn't doing this on purpose. It was just a screw-up. And this was going on for 9 months. Billions of ads ran in the wrong places for 9 months, and nobody knew. The agencies didn't know, the marketers didn't know, the people who are supposed to be scientific defenders of advertising spending didn't know. For 9 months, billions of ads, and nobody knew. How could that be? How could it be for 9 months, and these are major advertisers, did not know that their ads were running in the wrong place? It's because the online ad system is essentially opaque. Nobody knows what's going on. They don't know what they're buying. They don't know where it's running. They don't know how much they're paying, and they don't know who they're paying it to. It's a black box, and it's a recipe for fraud.
Yeah, you're right. According to the Wall Street Journal, at least 15 different ad tech companies that were part of the chain of buying, selling, and verification for Gannett had enough information to see what was going on. Not a single one of these companies discovered or reported it. As far as can be told, not a single company even understood what they were looking at.
Yep.
So, Bob, is there anything from Marketing Stinks that I didn't ask you about that I should have?
I don't think so. I think you covered it pretty well. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I certainly enjoyed it getting ready for this, the opportunity to talk to you.
Good.
Because so the listener knows, Bob won't talk to me any other way.
No.
Yeah. But I know that. And, you know, he's a New Yorker, and I know where I stand with him. So that's all good.
Yeah.
Well, so at marketingbookpodcast.com, like I mentioned, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including this book website web thingy.
Book like web thing.
Yeah, marketingstinks.com. And also Bob Hoffman's website and your LinkedIn profile. And now a word to you, dear listener. Please reach out to Bob and congratulate him on this and thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast so many times. But especially if he's pissed you off, would you reach out to him and just let him know? Because I want him to think that if he writes another book, he ought to come back on this podcast. So... There you go. Yeah, and you know, share the link, share this interview on LinkedIn and tag us so we can thank you, if nothing else. And if you're listening on your smartphone, you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts. All these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. The book-like web thing is Marketing Stinks, spelled MKTGSTINX. The author is Bob Hoffman. Bob, thank you very much for returning to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you, Douglas. It's been a pleasure once again.